AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction.
You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Well, the sun is shining, beans are reaching for $12. Sounds to me like a good day for a free-for-all.
Live from November 2020, via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, it's our Friday free-for-all. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and we welcome Duane Faber. Right after the news, Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal Sport joins us. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now, in for Chip Flory, here to keep us out of the rhubarb, our benevolent news overlord, John Harris.
Good morning, sir.
Rhubarb. You don't want to be in the rhubarb?
My rhubarb's dead. Mine's dead for this year.
A little late in the year, yeah.
Yeah. So your job should be easy today. Should be. Perhaps.
Keep us out of the rhubarb. All right. Well, we'll see. Jim Wiesmeyer tends to try to lead us into the rhubarb. We'll see if we can keep him on the straight and narrow today. As you, I love hearing you say that 2020.
Sure. Yeah. In true Baba Wawa's fashion.
Baba Wawa's.
It's my best Baba Wawa.
Excellent. Well, it should be a good show today. We're really looking forward to having Duane Faber join the conversation here on the Free For All and bringing you a bit of a dairy angle to things. We'll get into some of those issues with him. But first, what's happening in the news today, Davis?
Well, John, the labor market is flashing signs of slowdown in states where coronaviruses are surging and in places where coronavirus is not surging. The growth in the number of daily job postings in Midwestern states where the virus is raging is slowing sharply compared with October. That's according to data from the job site ZipRecruiter. But with other states among the lowest infection rates in the nation, including California, New York, and North Carolina, they're also seeing a slowdown. The Wall Street Journal reports regional data suggest it is not the level of COVID-19 infections, but rather how state officials, businesses, and consumers respond to the pandemic that appears to have the greater impact on the pace of the labor market's recovery in a state. This is kind of an interesting wrinkle here, John.
Yeah, it certainly is, and certainly even more so as it's reaching more into rural areas now as opposed to the coast of last March.
Mm-hmm. Well, Turkey Day road travel is expected to fall this year. Only 35% will travel by car this year, down from 65% a year ago, according to a survey from retail fuel tracker GasBuddy. The survey underscores how much consumer patterns have changed this year and is especially relevant to an oil industry that has been clobbered by an unprecedented drop in demand. That's according to Bloomberg. And we've heard on the show over the past couple of weeks, you know, well, maybe air travel is off, but at some point, you know, some people decided to get behind the wheel and do some traveling over the summer rather than flying. And the thought was, well, maybe that encourages some gasoline use. You know, we're talking about ethanol at that point. But if we're going to see a fall around Thanksgiving, gosh, I don't know. And then into Christmas, too. Who knows?
Yeah, and it could prove very interesting for the ethanol industry if that can see. You going anywhere for Thanksgiving next week?
No, I'm staying here, but I do have family traveling in from far-flung locations myself. So, you know, my family will be holding up our end.
All right, well, be careful. Yeah, we're doing the shelter in place just ourselves. I'm not even cooking. We're just doing carry out for Thanksgiving this year for the first time ever.
Oh, sure. Well, congressional leaders still are not meeting regarding what many believe to be another eventual COVID aid stimulus package. Farm state lawmakers and the ag sector hope for additional farmer aid. Meanwhile, it may take until the end of the year omnibus budget deal to see if USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation gets additional funding. A meeting yesterday with congressional leaders was about the end of the year government funding bill, which is due for renewal on December 11th. And it feels to me like our hopes for the CCC maintaining its status here are sketchy.
Yeah, and we'll get more details on that from Mr. Wiesmeyer here in just a little bit.
Excellent. Lawmakers are area of bipartisan compromise under the Biden administration, the Wall Street Journal reports, as Democrats and Republicans face the possibility of another 2 years of divided government. Efforts to craft a multi-year bill repeatedly fell apart during the Trump administration, and disagreements on the scope of the legislation and how to pay for it will persist under the new president. And I think that's the key right there, that phrase, how to pay for it, will continue to be not only on infrastructure, but, you know, of course, on stimulus. That's been the big sticking point. How to pay for it in a divided Congress. Gosh, you know.
Well, once they figure out what it is that they're going to pay for, which is the other big sticking point, somewhere between $500 billion and $3.4 trillion.
Just one sticking point at a time will do, John. I can't handle too many sticking points. It gets too sticky. Well, finally here, with fewer renewable identification numbers available due to lower ethanol demand and production, the price for one RIN has increased from 9.5 cents in January to an average of 63.96 cents so far this month, raising renewable fuel standards compliance costs for U.S. refiners. RIN prices are expected to continue on this upward trajectory for the remainder of the year amid uncertainty surrounding the 2021 mandate and the upcoming change in administration. That's according to S&P Global Platts Analytics. John, that's our news for this morning.
Hey, thanks, Davis. Appreciate the update.
You bet.
All right, let's turn now to Jennifer Scheich, who is the editor of Farm Journal's Pork. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for joining us. And we're seeing some early signs, hints that maybe we're returning to or have the potential to return to some of the problems we saw back this spring in packing plants. What are you seeing so far?
Well, I know that I was hearing some rumors circling around this week of plants that were refusing loads. And the questions were, are we going back to where we were? And I think the thing that comes to my mind, and I've talked to some people at the plants, is that workers are going to be getting sick right now. Iowa's crazy high for influenza numbers, not to mention COVID cases. You know, where we see some of these plants located right here in the heart of the Midwest, you know, we're experiencing workers who are going to have to take some quarantine time off. And so I think that, you know, I don't think we're going to be seeing a huge upset anytime soon, according to what the plants are telling me. But I do think we're going to have to be realistic that we're going to have more people needing to sit off and not work for a while. And that's not only in the packing plant industry, that's everywhere.
Yeah, do you have any signs that they're better prepared for this than they were last spring?
Oh, absolutely. I think they've learned a lot. I mean, I think the whole country has learned a lot about how we handle COVID and what we need to do. And the reality is the virus is going to be moving through and we're going to have to just deal with it as it comes. But we now have better protective gear that we can implement. The plants have made and invested billions of dollars into improving the plants and making it more adaptable to be able to keep workers safe. So I really do feel like the plants are doing everything they can. But, you know, the truth remains that this is a virus we haven't dealt with before. And so I think there's a lot of things we'll learn along the way.
All right. And quickly, on a brighter note, you're looking for, and this is certainly not me, the best mustache and beard in the pork industry.
I am pretty excited. We've had some great entries come in, but we still need some more. Particularly, we need more mustaches. I had a big request for that last year after we started the beard category. And so, you know, send those in to me by December 1st. You can just email it to me at jscheich@farmjournal.com. And we're just going to have a little bit of fun and celebrate some of the good-looking beards and mustaches we have out there.
John, right. Jennifer's also recruited me as a celebrity judge. So,
oh, really?
You know, if that helps at all. Jay
well,
Scheich,
certainly does
S-H-I-K-E, at farmjournal.com.
And you take bribes of bacon, yeah. Right?
100%.
All right. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with the Friday free-for-all coming up next right here on AgriTalk.
Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage just waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues like climate change. That's a lot of corn. Exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we use all this corn right here in the U.S.? POET is working hard to achieve nationwide E15, which will generate the demand necessary to use up ever-increasing corn yields, increasing the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10
to 15% would result in a market of almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year. That's the same as doubling exports, and that's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unify around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support Nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free resource stewardship planning guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
And welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm John Harith from Farm Journal, filling in for Chip Flory today. His last day of vacation. He'll be back with us on Monday. But, of course, it's the Friday free-for-all. We got with us today Dwayne Faber from out in Washington State, Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer, and, of course, Sean Haney, Real Agriculture up in Canada. And, Jim, all right, I know you're in the middle of this, so explain all the details of this mafia cabal that is undermining the election and installing Joe Biden as president. What are the details here for us, Jim?
I don't want to get into the details. It'll get me in trouble from either side, let me just tell you. Although Rudy, I was told, will be in line to, be an actor in the Munsters. Bottom line, I can't wait till December the 14th when we have a true, hopefully, accounting of the process. It's been ugly. There's no other word to say.
But aren't we likely to find out that the accounting when they get together on the 14th is no different than the accounting that happened before the 14th? Like, what has led us to believe it'll be different?
Well, Sean, the other side that says if you finagled the ballots to begin with, when you recount, it'll be recounted the same way. So, that's what the some to many Republicans say in Michigan.
Well, and that's what's happened so far with the recount. And I guess the recount in Wisconsin starts today. So we'll see what happens there. But the December 14th date is very key because that is when that gets certified. And really, Jim, the Trump administration loses basically all of their leverage to claim anything other than Joe Biden as the president-elect.
Absolutely. And for the first time, officially, we can say president-elect to whoever wins.
Indeed. All right. Well, we've talked enough about presidential election for the last however many weeks. So let's get into other issues. And let's hit on an election issue. Dwayne Faber, dairy farmer out in Washington. Dwayne, you were telling us just before we got started on the show that you had a big election issue there in Washington State, saying that now you may have to go back and pay 3 years back in overtime. What's this about?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on. So there was a recent court ruling in Yakima, Washington, where a couple of farm workers came forward saying they were not paid overtime. And so they were suing, saying that it was unconstitutional for ag to be exempt from paying overtime. And so the justices just ruled 5-4 in favor of the farm workers, saying that the farm workers are expected to, or they're allowed to get overtime pay in agriculture. And one of the opinions of one of the justices there also said he felt that farm workers could sue for 3 years of back pay for not getting paid overtime. And so, I mean, if that were to happen, it would be hundreds of millions of dollar judgment across the dairy sector. And as we speak now, there's lawyers combing vineyards and apple orchards and cherry orchards trying to seek out people that are affected in similar industries, and we're going to have contagion into other industries as lawsuits come forward suing to erode the ag overtime exemption. And so it just makes Washington agriculture more difficult to do ag in this state, and in a lot of other states, like in California, they do have ag overtime, but it was phased in, and it doesn't fully impact until 2025. And it starts at a 50-hour work week, and I believe New York is either 50 or 60 hours as well. That would be the other state that has an exemption, or there is no exemption for ag overtime. Whereas for us, we had to start paying overtime immediately, and it starts at 40 hours a week. And so very frustrating. It's frustrating for the guys, because now we're going to start limiting hours to 40 hours a week on the dairy farm, and we're going to seek ways to invest in technology to limit labor costs.
You'd be buying yourself a robot.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Robot feed pushers, robot milkers, robot scrapers. I mean, that's where this goes, right? And yeah, the intention of the courts and of these people is to make life easier for those who work in the dairy industry and really all agriculture. But the negative impact is, hey, we're going to start either dialing back wages or dial back pay and then paying overtime. And quite frankly, Washington, we pay some of the highest labor costs in the nation already, and it just makes us less competitive in a commodity industry where we're competing with other parts of the country. And I think it's going to exacerbate the shift into dairy and agriculture in the Midwest. You're going to see more and more of a push into the Midwest from the coast as they have to deal with these regulations.
Well, I would imagine that if they do indeed allow seeking 3 years in back overtime, that would, I would guess, force some producers out of business.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, for larger dairies, you're talking over $1 million, right? And management decisions were based on the rules in place at the time. And so, yeah, people were consistently giving 60 hours a week to their employees. And it's a little unfortunate because a lot of this type of work, if we're limited to 40 hours, people have to go and find a second job. Agriculture was nice for a lot of workers where they could go in, put in 60 hours and take home a livable wage. You know, whereas if you go in and work in town somewhere that's limiting you to 40 hours, a lot of these folks have to go and get a second job. And just the consistency of working for one place and the ability to put in 60 hours was helpful. And now management is going to make adjustments to that.
So how's the industry responding to it in Washington?
With trepidation and fear. I mean, it's not been good. I mean, for us, what we're going to do now, I mean, we're mandated our minimum wage is $13.50 an hour. So we're going to say, well, we'll pay you $13.50 an hour, and then we'll pay you overtime. And it should equal, and then we'll have a bonus column to make sure that they're still getting the same wages, but we're checking the box of meeting the minimum wage requirement and then also paying the mandatory overtime. And it should equal out to an average wage of $18, which is what most guys are paying in our area per hour. And, yeah, it's unfortunate, but there are ways around it, and so we do have to navigate it and figure out how to do it. But, yeah, across the board, we work on pretty slim margins already. And so, I mean, the perception is that there's all these assets and, you know, there's a whole bunch of money there, but we do run on slim margins. And unfortunately, it's going to hurt kind of the middle of the road farmers out here that have 600 to 1,000 cows. They're not as efficient as a 5,000, 6,000 cow dairy, because their labor costs are a lot less. They're more efficient. They've made some maybe bigger investments in technologies. And so it's only going to push further the shift into big agriculture and 5,000, 6,000 cow dairies. And if that's the way it goes, that's the way it goes. I mean, you can't fight City Hall on it. But the unintended consequences of this are much greater than the people realize who are trying to enforce these rules.
Wow, interesting. All right, well, let's stick on dairy for a little bit, and Sean and Jim jump in here too. But Dwayne, as we look forward to a Biden administration, what is the dairy industry looking for in a new administration, and as we ultimately look towards a new farm bill as well?
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, dairy farmers tend to do better under Democrats, and some of that is a weaker dollar, better exports, potentially opening up China to more purchases. You know, the downside is we fight the regulations. They give more strength to the EPA, and we've seen a pretty litigious EPA, particularly in Washington State, where they're suing to put dairies out of business. And those are the downsides of it. But on the economic side, we tend to do better. And I think opening up trade with China would be helpful for the U.S., and it looks like we're kind of heading that direction. It'll be interesting to see where the food box program goes. There was a lot of buying of cheese And it created a huge disparity in the market where cheese class three was up to $23, $24 and butter powder was down in $11 and $12. And so you have these huge regional disparities. Actually, you have these disparities even among states where one farmer is getting $24 per hundredweight for his milk and another farmer is getting $15 for his milk. And so anytime government steps in, there's winners and losers. And we certainly saw that with that food box program, which was a fairly successful program from a standpoint of feeding people and people that were food insecure. And I think it was the right thing to do, but it definitely created some huge disparities.
Yeah, but Jim, we're not likely to see that continue in a new administration, are we?
No, 100%. They'll come up with the Food Box Better program.
Food Box Better. I like that. All right, well, we'll get into more of this and some of what we can expect. I also want to get Dwayne's reaction to the loss of Colin Peterson, House Ag Committee Chairman, who has been a big advocate for dairy in the U.S. We'll talk about all that and more on the free-for-all here on Friday on AgriTalk. We've got Dwayne Faber from Washington State, Jim Wiesmeyer, policy analyst from Pro Farmer, and, of course, Sean Haney from Real Agriculture up in Canada. And I'm a minute ahead of myself heading into the break. So we've got a little bit of time here, Dwayne. Let's talk about your reaction to Colin Peterson losing his race up there in Minnesota.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer Plus Rewards, helping make every part of your season more rewarding.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues like climate change. Nationwide E15 would generate demand for increasing corn yields. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol would result in a market of almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year. That's the same as doubling exports, and that's 2 billion reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more about supporting Nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And our expert from Pro Farmer is Jeff Wilson. Jeff, some green on the board today. What's going on?
Good morning, John. Yes, we had a nice, we opened a little bit lower in corn and beans last night. And once again, buyers came in, pushed the beans to new contract highs. The bean oil went to new contract highs. The March corn could not make a new contract high. And now, and the also the other thing was the meal market has not made a new contract high along with the beans and the oil. So now we're getting to see a little bit of profit taking come back in. Beans are more than a dime off their highs. You know, we have a holiday week coming up. Beans are up over 30 cents for the week, $1.20 for the month. You know, why don't you just take some profits and then don't go and have a family Thanksgiving. Just go home and have some turkey and enjoy your profits. But anyway, the story is there's a little bit of rain in the forecast next week. That might have tempered some of the bullishness, but the story remains. It's a smaller supplies, both U.S. and global, for corn and beans. We have Chinese demand that's strong, and you have a South American weather situation that's up for grabs.
All right, what about on the livestock side?
Those markets are very mixed this morning. Both of them had sharp sell-offs yesterday on fears that we'd have some slaughter plants that might go down with the rising COVID infections. Both markets ignored positive fundamentals yesterday in terms of stronger domestic meat prices and better beef export sales. Today, the pork is actually higher, and the cattle continue to go a little bit lower. Those markets are just trying to figure out where we're going to go in terms of slaughter operations over the course of the next two months. And so it's very cautious trade in there.
All right, it's Jeff Wilson from Pro Farmer.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize Corteva for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
And welcome back to Free for All on AgriTalk. I'm John Harris filling in for Chip Flory. He'll be back with us on Monday. A couple of the usual cast of characters, Sean Haney from Real Agriculture in Canada, Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer, and joining us this week as well, Dwayne Faber, a dairy farmer from Washington State. And, you know, now that Sean has given me a refresher course on reading a clock during the break, I think we're back on track. track. Dwayne, the question I was going to ask before I misread the clock was that, you know, we lost a big influence in agriculture and particularly dairy with Colin Peterson, House Ag Committee Chairman, losing his race in Minnesota. What is the impact on the dairy industry with that loss?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, he was always kind of a stable head in the immigration discussion, right? And for somebody that's coming from the left, we always felt like he represented us well and represented the needs of those coming into the country and looking for a better life. And so that is an incredible loss. And as his policies on international trade, it was something that we appreciated in agriculture. A lot of our products we had exported, and so we are always in support of free trade. I mean, a lot of the Trump administration policies of this nationalism and isolationism, I think, negatively impacted us, and he was always an advocate for free trade, and it's unfortunate to see that he lost that, and we're hoping that he gets replaced with somebody with a similar mindset, and that is potentially one of the benefits of a Biden administration as well.
Well, speaking of free trade, Sean Haney, the largest trade agreement in the world was enacted this week, and the U.S. is on the sidelines.
The U.S. and Canada are both outside of it. There is opportunity, I read, for other countries to join after the fact, which we'll have to see if either of our two countries approach that. But it is a very, very large trade pact, makes up a significant amount of the world GDP. It involves China and Japan, as well as South Korea. So we have the ASEAN plus one plus one. I think you guys hit on it last week, India is out by their choice, but obviously not an easy country to deal with. Modi has really taken India in a very populist direction. And so this deal maybe ties them a little bit too close to China for sort of nationalistic comfort. It's something we got to really, really watch as this is a very substantial multilateral deal. But quite frankly, I think it's, on the other hand, U.S. has a deal with China. They have a deal with South Korea, and they also have a deal with Japan. So they have bilateral deals that make up the key members of this new RCEP agreement.
Yeah, but Jim, this is really China saying, hey, we're trying to take over the U.S.'s role as the global leader in trade, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the key takeaway here, and Sean finally hit it. There are other trade agreements between the countries, which frankly are better, and there's better tariff levels, lower that is, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement, now called CPTPP.
What's interesting, which again, the U.S. is not a part of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That Biden wants to get back into with changes.
Yes.
Yeah, and one of the things I also read that's a bit of a difference in this agreement for those Asian nations is there actually is dispute resolution in it. Now, typically, apparently, Asian nations used to go to the WTO for their dispute resolution, but with the kind of the chaos that mechanism is in, there is dispute resolution in it. And one of the other key benefits for those countries that are in this deal is country of origin and how they calculate that. And from what I've read, it is a much smoother process than definitely we have, for example, in the USMCA.
Indeed. Dwayne, from a producer perspective, how do you see China flexing its muscle like this?
Yeah, it's always a little bit scary, right? We were the leader in the room, and unfortunately, a lot of that has gone by the wayside. The wins potentially for us would be the USMCA. I know that impacted Canada a little bit, but it's a little bit scary, right? And in talking with these labor laws and as they make agriculture more difficult, one thing we saw through COVID is food is a national security issue. And if we want our food to be made by the cheapest producers possible, a lot of our food is going to be coming from other parts of the world that don't have any of the regulations that we have. And so these global trade issues do become national security issues, and food does as well. And so it's unfortunate to see some of that, and we're going to have to make decisions as a society on what we want and where we want our food to come from, and it all ties into trade.
Indeed, indeed. Let's talk a little bit about where the food's coming from. And in the first segment with Jennifer Scheich, we talked about some of the challenges that our domestic processing facility had in handling COVID-19. And Sean, now some kind of disturbing news coming out of a lawsuit in Iowa of how those packing plants were handling the COVID-19 cases. You want to explain some of the details on that?
Yeah. So really kind of, you know, at first read, it's a bit of a stomach turner in the sense of sort of the lack of empathy. So as plants were being criticized for lack of protection for plant workers, some members of management at a Tyson facility were running a betting game of how many employees that day would contract the virus, which, maybe there's some details that'll come out as this court case proceeds that will maybe shed some, maybe there's a different side to this story, but at first glance, it's pretty awful. It's pretty disgusting. And it is definitely not, as Packers try to shed some of these accusations from a branding standpoint, this is not helping it.
No, it's not. In fact, the further accusations in that lawsuit, and again, they are accusations at this point, but about workers essentially being forced to return to work and not get tested for COVID. So it'll be interesting to see how that lawsuit proceeds. Now, as Jennifer pointed out, it does appear that the Packers have learned a lot of lessons from that earlier outbreak and hopefully can respond in a better fashion in this second wave that does seem to be hitting some of those rural areas more heavily. Jim, do you think those Packers are ready for this wave that we're seeing now?
Well, they're better. But when you have the number of cases that's in rural America, that's what the market's worried about right now, is another shoe going to fall. You can use algorithms, which Tyson and others are doing, and that's definitely helped predict the possibility. But, you know, the more it increases in rural America where those processing plants on, it could happen again.
Because, well, also we're seeing buying up a really ramp good up point. Now, which... I said we're seeing buying ramp up now too, which could also exacerbate that problem.
Yes.
Jim brings up a really good point in the fact that, you know, there was a lot of workers that contracted the virus at this time, but they didn't necessarily get it from working at the facility. There was a lot of virus that was contracted based on, you know, commuting to work, the living situation of some of the workers. And so as we see cases rise in some of these rural areas where there are these plants, the risk just gets even heightened even more than it was in the spring, and a vaccine could not come soon enough for some of these workers.
Yeah, indeed. And Dwayne, I'm sure this is something that weighs on your mind with your employees. How do you address this in your facility?
Yeah, you bet. Sean hit on it pretty succinctly. I mean, a lot of the farm workers are living together, and so there's a lot of intermingling, and so oftentimes they're picking it up in the house. And so I've had situations where an employee did not have COVID himself, but his dad did, who was also a farm worker, and then now he has to isolate for 14 days, and then he picked it up, so now he has to isolate for another 14 days, right? And so the ramifications of this are huge, and it's just a domino effect on who it impacts and how quickly it spreads. And no, this isn't real. This is expensive, and we need to get that vaccine because it has made life difficult. And so we've gone to temperature testing everybody. There's several testing stations nearby that we're able to send guys to if they feel like they are symptomatic, to go and see if they have it. And yeah, anytime somebody does come down with it or in a house where somebody has had it, we send them home for 14 days till we know where it's at. And it's made life difficult for sure. So it's kind of a long, cold winter, and we're looking forward to the spring again. So
have you had enough impact that it's impacted your operation at any point so far this year?
Not so much. We've been able to move people around and get it figured out and kind of fill in the gaps for people. And so it has impacted us. Absolutely. But it's just juggling people and trying to move people around. And I mean, the good news is once somebody has had it, now they're good to go, and they're going to be solid going forward. So that is something to be thankful for. Hopefully you only have to invest 14 days per person in this, and then we kind of get to the point where, yeah, we reach herd immunity. I've only had two people that have gotten it, and but outside that, as far as we know, everybody has still not gotten it. So.
Well, that's good. You've been fortunate there with keeping it that low. We're talking with Dwayne Faber, who's a dairy farmer out in Washington State, along with Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer and Sean Haney from Rural Agriculture up in Canada with the Friday free-for-all. We've got lots more to get to in the remaining moments about this. We're going to talk a little bit about carbon sequestration and the push there when we come back on the Friday free-for-all. So stick around. We've got a lot more to come right here on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize the National Corn Growers Association for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
And welcome back to the free-for-all. John Harris sitting in for Chip Flory, along with Dwayne Faber, Jim Wiesmeyer, and Sean Haney. And Jim, we had a caller off air wanting to know an update on what you've been looking into on the WIP Plus program and the delay in payments there.
Well, I've been told that USDA has halted paying WIP Plus payments because they need to go through what's called a reapportionment process with the Office of Management and Budget. The good news is that payments will be made, but we're still waiting on the quality loss, you know, program payment details. I will tell you that after we talked about this topic November 13th on Signal to Noise, I had a listener email me, just thought you might like to know we received our WIP Plus payments this past week for 2019, but still waiting for WIP Plus 2018.
Wow. Yeah, so this is for various natural disasters in 2018 and 2019. The process has just been painfully slow.
It has been. And I do predict that there will be a similar program, they may call it something else, for 2020 because of the problems that we had in different regions of the country.
All right. In particular, I'm sure you're looking at the derecho damage in Iowa and Illinois from that. All right. Well, keep us updated on that as it comes in, Jim. Speaking of a long time waiting, we're still waiting for a COVID aid package. And I guess it's been declared dead many times. And then they keep saying that there's life in it. But man, I'm not seeing much breathing going on, Jim.
Well, it's not dead. It's just to be a date to be determined. You had some confusing comments from the Democratic leaders in Congress last night that they were either going to meet or had met. But then McConnell came out and said no. We met on other things, such as the fiscal year 2021, you know, spending matters. But eventually, they will come together. I don't know whether it'll be this year or not.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll continue to wait and see. Sean, there was we have been talking for the last few weeks about this notion that the Biden administration says that they want to have climate addressed across every agency, every facet of government. And then, lo and behold, we're seeing a lot of reaction in agriculture that isn't necessarily timed to that, but is coming out at an interesting time, including this coalition, FACA, that is a coalition of a wide number of ag and environmental groups saying what their priorities are for meeting climate. We've seen a lot of seed companies come out with various carbon sequestration programs. Are we seeing a significant change in tide in how ag is looking at climate change?
Well, I think we better because we need to figure out how we're going to be a part of how we fit into this equation. So traditionally, I think what ag has done across North America is fight it and struggle with words like sustainability. we got to figure out how to wrap ourselves in the cloak a little bit and see what the opportunity is here. Is a Biden administration is going to make climate a priority. He's made that pretty clear throughout the campaign. And so where do we fit in that? Getting paid for carbon sequestration is just one of those things. Now, Jim can probably shed light on whether or not they can use CCC funds for that. Yeah. But I like the idea of trying to figure it out. And we should be trying to figure out where the opportunity is for our industry.
Well, I want to take one issue with what you said, though, Sean, and it's part of the frustration, I think, of a lot of producers. And Dwayne, I'd like to get your reaction to this. But I think there's been frustration in that ag has been, in many ways, on the leading edge of this. When you look at things like conservation tillage, strip till, cover crops, those types of things, and then not getting credit for it as there is a bigger push on agriculture and other industries to make changes because of climate change. And I think one of the changes we're seeing in the approach now is that there is recognition for the work that agriculture has done and even financial reward for some of the work that agriculture has already been doing. What's your reaction to that, Dwayne?
Yeah, my animal agriculture take is a little bit different because even Cory Booker is pushing the administration to get rid of CAFO permits, right? And this is somebody that has stated his goal is to end animal agriculture. And so getting in bed with somebody that wants to end animal agriculture, it's not going to go well, even if in the short term you feel like they're making decisions that will benefit you. I mean, their stated goal is to get rid of animal agriculture. And so how do we, you know, like Sean said, wrap ourselves in the cloak of science and saying, hey, we're in this fight too, without being pushed out completely as a dairy industry or in the animal agriculture industry, because I think that's where they want to go with it. And that's my fear, that that's where they're heading towards it. And I mean, we can paint a sustainability story in agriculture too. I mean, we're reducing the use of chemicals and pesticides. We're using cow manure. We're not working up the ground as much as maybe some of our other counterparts. And so there is a sustainability story in dairy, but that gets clouded over quickly by the methane output and the belief that dairy is negatively impacting the climate.
We got to be in the room. Farmers I've talked with, lots of emails on this. They want to see the details. They say implementation should be voluntary, and they hope ag carbon bank trading companies don't make the majority of any money out of this, and they want it designed from the bottom up rather than the top down, not allowing a lobbyist to dictate the main provisions. And as far as payments from what farmers and ranchers have already done, they're usually called legacy or pioneer payments, and I fully expect that to be included. Final note on USDA CCC, I've learned over 40 years that lawyers in USDA go to where the secretary wants a legal determination to be made.
So you're saying that they need congressional action in order to be able to pull money from CCC in order to do that?
I think eventually they will, but lawyers from USDA can initially say they see within the Charter Act the opportunity to do this if the Ag Secretary wants a lawyer to say that. I've learned that they'll say whatever the Ag Secretary wants, but it could be challenged, of course.
All right, and quickly, with the CCC, are we going to see that funding come back in some sort of omnibus spending bill?
Yes, but yeah, it'll be in the omnibus spending bill. At what level and what stipulations? Those are the that's the language, that I will look for, John.
All right. Hey, really enjoyed it, guys. That's Jim Wiesmeyer, Sean Haney, and Dwayne Faber on today's Free For All. Ted Seifried's going to be your host this afternoon on the PM show, so be sure to tune in for that. Chip Flory will be back on Monday. Thanks for joining us right here on AgriTalk.